blanking on the, Babylon, during the time of their conquest. So then there was a first return, which we don't talk about a lot, but it's in the beginning of Ezra. It was under a person called Zerubbabel, and they came back in 538 BC, and they came back to build the temple and the walls, and they got partway there. Then in 457, Ezra came with the note from the king, and they restarted the building. So these two are discussed in the book of Ezra. And then the last return came with Nehemiah in 444. And then, of course, we were talking about that a few weeks ago. They finally finish everything. Esther fits historically near the time of Ezra's return, 457-ish. The king, Artaxerxes, in the book of Ezra, is believed to be the same king as in Esther, although he's called Ashurish. I don't know why that's the nickname for Artaxerxes, but I'm not a Greek scholar, or this is not in Greek. This book is written in another Aramaic, or anyway, it's... nevertheless, that is what the claim is. And in fact, the claim is that in Ezra 7, verse 14, when he talks about the seven counselors of Artaxerxes, the king is telling Ezra, you know, as you go back, whereas you are being sent by the king and his seven counselors to inquire concerning Judah and Jerusalem with regard to the law of your God, which is in this land. So he's basically saying, you are being sent with the blessing of the king and the seven counselors, that those seven counselors were in fact the same seven counselors as mentioned in Esther 1, when the king wants to know what to do with this unruly queen, and he invites the counselors in Esther 1 verses 13 and 14. King said to his wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner towards all who knew law and justice. The closest to him were, and then it lists these seven people, Garshinas, Shethar, Adamantha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcina, and Memucan. Memucan is a real sweetheart. We'll meet him a little later. These are the seven princes of Persia and Media, and the belief is that those were, in fact, the same seven that Ezra, the book of Ezra, refers to, that they were sent with the blessing of these seven. These were the princes, the rulers of regions under the kingdom. So there's a king of Persia. The kings of Persia, starting with Darius. Darius has a son, Xerxes. And there's a couple different versions of this, but Aristotle apparently wrote in Politics what his version was. I'll give you that one. Xerxes was murdered by Artabanus, and then Artaxerxes, which I guess means grandson, I don't know, maybe means junior, Xerxes Junior. But so Xerxes was a son that was murdered. Artaxerxes is a grandson of Darius. He becomes king. He avenges the murder of his father by killing Artabanus. And apparently there was a lot of this killing. I'm skipping a lot of the intrigue because there was lots of repercussions going on at this time, lots of brutality and killing going on. But this is where Artaxerxes comes from. So let's begin. I'm just going to read through and discuss the story starting in Esther chapter 1. Now that we kind of know where we are and who's who. Now it came to pass in the days of Ashurus, this is Artaxerxes, this was the Ashurus who ruled over 127 provinces from India to Ethiopia. In those days when King Ashurus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which is in Shushan, the citadel, that it was the third year of his reign, and he made a feast for all of his officials and servants. The powers of Persia and Media, the nobles, the princes of the provinces being before him, and he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. So there was a kingdom. Media and the Medians and the Persians, the Medo-Persian Empire. There was a king, Ashurus. Most believe this is called Artaxerxes, grandson of Darius. There was a safe city, a place where the king went when he wanted to relax and chill for a while. It was fortified and protected. It was called Shushan. That's where the king is hanging out. And he's feeling all good about himself right now. And there's a great big carnival. I don't know what to call it. This is like a state fair that has everything. But the purpose of the fair was to show what a great king Ahasuerus was. All the stuff he collected, all the things they could do, all of the food that they could prepare. It was one great big party, and it lasted for 6 months. And they ended it with one great big beautiful terribly fattening feast that lasted 7 days. When these days were completed, this is verse 5, and the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small in the court of the garden of the king's palace. There were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods and marble pillars, and the couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. There were served drinks in golden vessels, each vessel being different than the other, with royal wine in abundance, according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, drinking was not compulsory. For so the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. I think that's interesting, the details they give us. So we have a big, beautiful, terribly fattening feast that was going on for apparently everyone in the city. It's like a never-ending potluck that you didn't have to bring anything to. As I can see, this, it was there. That dining hall was like nothing we've ever seen. The floor was made from a white and black marble in some kind of a mosaic that included turquoise stone, and this translucent, almost, you can almost see through its stone called alabaster. That's just the floor. And on the floor, they put couches. The couches were apparently made out of silver, and some made using gold. There were pillars in the hall that were made of solid marble. And lining the walls, there was beautiful linen, white and blue curtains and purple curtains. It was colorful, it was elaborate, and it was beautiful. The king had golden cups for everyone to drink from. They're like snowflake cups. No two were alike. They were all uniquely crafted and different. There was plenty of wine for everyone. But the law said you can't make people drink, so he made sure that everyone understood they didn't have to drink, but they could if they wanted to. At least that was not compulsory. Apparently some other things, which we will find out in a minute, were compulsory, but that one you could get away with not doing. Meanwhile, verse 9 tells us that Queen Vashti was having a feast of her own for all of the women in the palace. Probably it was equally as beautiful, but there was probably a lot less food on the floor, since I gather that the other one was where the guys were. So, verse 10, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Agatha, Sethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs. I read all the names so that you could count. Yeah, there were seven of them. He commanded to the ones who served the presence of the king, Ahasuerus, to go and bring the queen before the king. I guess she was a lady that needed a lot of convincing. Anyway, he sent seven guys over there to get her. Asked her to bring her before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and the officials, for she was beautiful to behold. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command brought by his eunuchs. Therefore the king was furious, and anger burned within him. So the king wants to borrow the queen for a bit. He wants her to get all fixed up and come and show the guy's room how beautiful she is. So you can see this is probably not, you know, going to... this is going to be very awkward, right? He wants them to come in so they can whistle or whatever they did back in those days. And Vashti is not really wanting to be the guys' hall entertainment tonight. And she says, no, I'm in the middle of something, or I'm going to serve the cream puffs, or whatever she was doing over there. She said no. And after all seven servants tried to convince her, she still said no. And they went back to tell the king, and the king is cranky. It says, anger burned within him. That means he's cranky. And the king said to the wise men who understood the times, now these are the seven that we talked about at the beginning, that are believed to be the same seven as in Ezra. For this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice. Those closest to him, Karshina, Shethar, Adamantha, Tarshish, Merez, Marcina, and Memucan, the sweetheart. The seven princes of Media and Persia, who had access to the king's presence and ranked highest in the kingdom. He asked them, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to the law, because she did not obey the king, the command of King Ahasuerus brought to her by the eunuchs. So the king apparently doesn't decide on his own. He has to call his counselors to figure out, okay, what does the law say? This is a country that is apparently very strongly believes in their laws. And he calls the guys together because they know the laws best. And they say, what does the law say should happen if the king summons his queen to show her off to the guys and she won't come? Or something close to that. What does the law say ought to be done? What should we do here? So Memucan has an idea. And Memucan answered before the king and the princes. Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also the princes and all the people who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will become known to all the women, so that they will despise their husbands in their eyes. When they report, the king Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she did not come. Memucan rightly predicting that Vashti would become a big hit with the ladies. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will all say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus, there will be excessive contempt and wrath. If it pleases the king, let a royal decree go out from him, and let it be recorded in the laws of the Medes, the Persians and the Medes, so that it cannot be altered, that Vashti shall come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. When the king's decree, which he will make, is proclaimed throughout all his empire, for it is great, all wives will honor their husbands, both great and small. So, there is another thing in this kingdom, apparently. There are laws that the king can write that nobody can disobey. I know that's hard for us to conceive right now because people write laws and then everybody just ignores them. That's the world we live in. But back then, apparently, there were the laws of the Medes and Persians. When it's written, nobody could disobey them. Not even the king could disobey a law that was written, even if he was the one that wrote the law. By the way, does this sound familiar from another Bible story you heard? Where the king's counselor tries to get him to write a law that he can't, not even he can undo. Anyone remember the story? Rebecca, you remember. Daniel in the lion's den, right? And the counselors get the king to write a law that says if Daniel prays, it's not if Daniel, if anybody prays, then they get thrown to the lions. The king regrets it because now he's going to have to feed one of his favorite people to the lions, right? And so God protects him. This is the same restriction, and the counselors are again trying to twist it and make it useful to their purposes. So the seven wise guys, counselors, all men, convinced the king that he should throw her out. And he should do this before all the ladies of the land get the idea that they can say no whenever their husband makes an unreasonable request. They wouldn't want the ladies to get that idea. So this will keep, they say, this will keep the wives honoring their husbands. I think it's kind of a funny choice of word. It shows to me how little they understood or knew about real honor. It's not going to keep them honoring their husbands, and it might keep them quiet. But a funny thing just to me, it shows how little they understood. The next king, that's the next queen that King Ashurus finds, by the way, did show honor to him, but was no less determined in herself. She was not a pushover either, if you remember the rest of this story. So King Ashurus says, great, let's go with this plan, Memucan. Memucan has the plan, let's do it. And verse 21, and the reply pleased the king and the princes, and the king did all according to the words of Memucan. And then he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province in its own script, and to every people in their own language, that each man should be a master in his own house and speak the language of his own people. Things that I get from chapter 1. This king is not a very nice guy. This whole culture is not a very nice culture. But this king is arrogant, he's selfish, he's bad-tempered. The king's counselors are also not very nice guys. Memucan's particularly a sweetheart, as I call him. And if you were near the king or his princes, especially if you were a lady, things are oppressive, they're unfair, and they're harsh. Into this wicked and decadent regime in this city come two really decent people. I'm going to introduce them at the beginning of the next chapter, Mordecai and Esther. They have integrity, honesty, they understand what honor looks like, loyalty, and they have a strong passion for serving God. They're going to get eaten alive, aren't they? That's what we would think. You can't take two nice people that don't want to treat people mean and stick them in the middle of this nest of this hive of harsh, selfish, arrogant people and them survive. But who do you think is going to win this struggle? God's going to win it. Yeah. Somehow it is easy for us to see when we look at Esther, we say, yeah, these people are all a bunch of bad guys, but God's going to win this in the end. It's easier for us to see it when we're reading the Bible story. It's a little harder for us to see it when we're living in our lives today and seeing people who have bad motives, people who are fighting against everything that God wants to do. And we see how strong and powerful they are, it is harder for us to believe that God is going to win this in the end. But when we read Esther, it's like, Ashurus doesn't have a chance. When we look at our life, we think, well, we don't have a chance. I think this Bible story, it illustrates to us how honest, simple people with a passion for God that rise to the call and situation that he puts them in. When it happens, entire mountains of evil intentions come crashing down. And this is the way of God's people with the kings. It is not usually something superhuman that they do. It is just ordinary people playing their part in a role that he gave them at the time. It's a Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego not eating the king's food. It's those guys not bowing before the king's idol. It's like, no, I'm not going to do that. We'll see what happens. Another message that I find from this story, actually, all the set of three stories. Don't let the badness of the bad guys discourage you and make you think that this is going to come out bad, because they are not God's messengers and they are not God's deliverance. In this story, the bad guys don't actually change. They stay bad guys all the way through it. But that didn't stop God's deliverance. Look for what God is doing. Look for what the good things are that are going on. And don't despair when the badness of the bad guys doesn't change, because that is not necessarily have to happen for God to deliver. He has his own plan, and it comes his own way. Chapter 2. After these things, when the wrath of King Ashurus subsided, he remembered Vashti and what he had done and what had been decreed against her. Yes, I guess He's thinking, there was that thing about finding the other one, finding that other one. What should we do about that? The king is thinking. And the king's servants who attended him said, let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers over all the provinces of this kingdom, that they may gather all beautiful young virgins to Shushan, the citadel, into the woman's quarters under the custody of Haggai. This is not the prophet Haggai. This is the other guy. The king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beautiful preparations be given to them, and let the young women who please the king be, the young woman who pleases the king become queen instead of Vashti. So the king's servants, don't know which seven these servants are, come to the king and say, hey, we have a great idea. Since we do everything big here, let's have a great big beauty contest to pick you and your next wife. We'll have all the guys go around to the dominions and gather up whoever looks promising and bring them to your head, I don't know, cosmetologist or whatever you call this guy. Haggai, the lady that helps, the guy that helps the ladies get prepared. He will work on them for a year so they're as pretty as they can be, and then you can pick the one you want. King likes this idea. He says, okay, let's go with that. And the Bible's version is this thing pleased the king, and he did so. Then verse 5, in Shushan, the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. This traces Mordecai's lineage back to a particular person, Kish, who was taken from Jerusalem in the original exile. So it's for one, making, I think is interesting, placing this squarely in a real place, in real time, in real history. This is the guy's parents and descendants. This is what happened to them. This is who this was. And there's no question about what person he's talking about. The other thing I think that's interesting about this is it clarifies completely that Mordecai was one of the Jews that later on in the king's decree would be killed. And it makes it perfectly clear that both he and Esther are Jews, descended from Benjamin, and came from Jerusalem. And Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father or mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So Mordecai's young cousin, Esther, loses her parents. So Mordecai takes her in and raises her. She just happens to be the right age and a pretty young girl that is a perfect contestant for the king's beauty pageant, for lack of a better word. So it was, verse 8, and the king's command and decree was heard that many young women were gathered at Shushan, the citadel, under the custody of Haggai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace, into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now the young woman pleased him, and that is, she pleased Haggai, and she obtained his favor, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her, besides her allowance. Then seven choice maidservants were provided to her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. So they take Esther, and she goes to Haggai the cosmetologist. Actually, he's a lot more than a cosmetologist, as you'll see in the next section. He's more than a makeup and hair and nails guy. They took day spa to a whole new level back in these days. They got 6 months of oil of myrrh. I'm not really sure what that looks like, but that's what they did. And then they got 6 months with the perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. So this was like year spa instead of day spa. And in the process, Esther makes a really good impression on Haggai. He starts to really like her. And he gives her even more of the good stuff than the others. And he gives her seven maids. They apparently like sevens. So this is really good for Esther. She gets seven maids around in another big room with, I don't know, seven extra beds maybe. And they give her a nice place. and anything that she needed, and nothing but the best. And then chapter 10, Esther had not revealed to her people or her family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. So apparently the Jews were not liked. I'm sure there's a lot more to this history, but it was dangerous to reveal yourself as a Jew, and she kept that secret. And Mordecai is terrified what's going to happen to Esther. And apparently, it's not like he has contact with her, but he's pacing, it says. He's pacing back and forth, wondering what's going to happen to her. How's this going to go? And he's worried for his young cousin. Verse 12, in each young woman's turn came... Each young woman's turn came to go into the king Ahasuerus after she had completed the 12 months preparation according to the regulations for women. And for thus were the days of their preparation appointed, 6 months with the oil of myrrh and 6 months with the perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters of the king's palace. In the evening she went in, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the women, to the custody of Sheshgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines, and she would not go into the king again unless the king delighted in her and called her by name. This passage, the end of this passage in particular, shows, I think, really clearly how truly brutal this whole arrangement was. I'm going to tell you something in code, which about three quarters of you will understand. These ladies started in the virgin's house, and they ended up in the concubine's house. They did not go back to the virgin's house. They went to the new guy, and they saw the new guy. And it just shows the brutality and the ownership that they felt, apparently the king felt over the women and the young women in the kingdom. So it's like, don't think oppressive cultures, think Afghanistan. The kind of view that was in the young women, I don't know if that's the perfect analogy, but you see what I mean, that these were not nice guys. And she was not in a very good situation. No wonder Mordecai was afraid for her. No wonder he was anxious and nervous. Finally, it's Esther's turn. Verse 15. Now, when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who he had taken as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in sight of all who saw her. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into the royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. The king loved Esther more than all the other women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. And so he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So she's the one. What do you think the king is going to want to do now that he picked his queen? Right. The king made a great feast. A feast for Esther, for all of his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the province and gave gifts according to the generosity of the king. Now, God's servant is firmly in place. He has a plan ready. Esther is exactly where God wants her to be. She is queen for a selfish, arrogant, bad-tempered king who's attended by heartless and brutal counselors, all of whom appear to like feasting more than anything else. It probably didn't feel like she was right where God wanted her, but she was. It was, and I'm not sure what she felt like, what she was supposed to do each day, but this was it. This was God's plan. And all she needed to do now was to wait for the rest of it to come to pass. And in verse 19, in the next section, we'll start to see it unfold. Verse 19 says, and the virgins were gathered together a second time. Mordecai sat within the king's gate. So there was this pass, there's the time that passed, and apparently the king liked these whole first beauty pageants so well, they decided to do it a second time. But in the meantime, Mordecai has gotten promoted. a few times, and he's sitting in the king's gate. This is a position of honor, and they're supposed to be watching and listening and being loyal guardians for the king and for the kingdom. But in all of this, they've still kept their secret, and they haven't revealed, Esther or Mordecai haven't revealed who they were, that is, that they were Jews. Now Esther, verse 20, had not revealed her family and her people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as she was brought up by him. Now verse 21, in those days when Mordecai sat within the king's gates, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigtan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So the matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. When an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on the gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. Writing things in the books is apparently very important because they would go back and look at them later when they wanted to know exactly what happened. So this arrogant, selfish, bad-tempered king, who is attended by heartless and brutal counselors, all of them lazy and liking to feast more than anything else, got some of their servants mad. Surprised? Not really. Bigtan and Teresh are planning to kill King Ahasuerus. I don't know, maybe he deserves it. And here's what surprises me. Really surprises me. What could Mordecai and Esther do? They could keep quiet. It's not really in their business, is it? They could think, just keep quiet. Would the world end if King Ahasuerus was killed? She might be unqueened, and she might be free to go home. Actually, it would not have been uncommon for a king to get assassinated. As I'm reading through the history, this was like happened. It happened a lot. I guess this was their version of checks and balances. If you get the servants too upset, they just might kill you. That's about all they had. Maybe Esther wouldn't have to be queen if all this happened. They could leak it to the press. They could whisper to the guard or leave him a note anonymously saying, you should check in with Bigtan. He's got plans. Or leak it to some talkative court busybody or something like that, so that if things go bad for the king, they wouldn't be the next in line to be killed. Think about it. It's not really good to be known as super loyal to the king that just got assassinated because he was a brute. Because what are they going to do next? Go clean out all the people that were loyal to him so they don't come after you, right? Esther could go to the king with this and not tell her where she got it from. Maybe protect Mordecai a little at least. Or they could just go openly, telling names and being completely open and honest about everything, telling the bad guys' names, telling their own names, and that is exactly what they did. Why? I'm not hoping to win the king's favor? Actually, I don't think so. This is just a guess. I just think honesty and honor and loyalty was so much of a part of them, they just acted the way they were. They naturally acted in the best interest of the king, even though he was not their favorite person. It reminds me of Daniel. And he acted in the best interest of King Nebuchadnezzar, and then in the best interest of King Darius. Those are two different kingdoms, by the way. Nebuchadnezzar was the Babylonian king, and then Darius was the first king of this Medo-Persian empire. And remember how Daniel served them and was loyal to them, and he was loved by them also. Saving the children of Israel did not require a revolt or even disrespect of the king or their laws. The good people, with a passion for God, acted simply with honesty and integrity towards a godless king, and the result was the deliverance of God's people. God can work with any rotten situation to do his work. He can use his people to do it. I'm wrapping up now, I know, leaving you with lots of questions. In Jerusalem, Ezra and Nehemiah were opposed by the local people when they tried to build a temple in the walls. They stood up and said, no, we're not going to stop. God gave us a mission, the king gave us a mission, and if you try to stop, we're going to draw swords against you, and we'll have it out right here. But we're not stopping. That was their approach, and God blessed them, and they had the law and the king behind them. Meanwhile, in the citadel, Esther and Mordecai are in the king's power, and they show honor to him in spite of the fact that he was arrogant and godless. And they even protected the king's life. And God used Esther and Mordecai to protect his people in that situation too. It's an interesting combination of stories, and I think there's a lot to learn. There is a time to draw swords, like in Ezra and Nehemiah, and there is a time for prayers, like you see in Ezra and Nehemiah, and you see it here also, as Mordecai is pacing out front and praying for Esther, as you see later when Esther goes into the king at risk, that Mordecai is praying for her. There's a time for prayers, and that's always. And there's a time for honor and honesty, even towards people that don't deserve it. I wish I had all the answers to tell you when is which, and I don't. But it's a remarkable set of stories, and I think it's showing maybe more than anything that God will use his people to get his job done however it needs to happen. And that he didn't forget them. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this story, and thank you for the wonderful deliverance that you brought to your people back then. I pray that you would use your people here today to bring deliverance for your people that need it also. I pray that you would use us in wherever we are, and you would show us what is our role, what is your plan for us, that we would do it with integrity, with honesty, that we would do it as your servants, that your will could be done. Help us to be able to see, understand, and to follow what you're doing. Do not be discouraged when things seem like they're not going well. I pray that you would just show us your plan so you would use us and protect us. Father, I pray you would bless each family that is here. I pray that you would bless our time of fellowship. And I pray you would bless our celebration. Bless Isaac this afternoon as he makes his first step in his walk with you. That you would just bless him with you.